Okay, Jack. Thank you for coming. For people who don't know who you are a former KGB sleeper agent who worked for the KGB for 10 years spying on America and eventually worked with the FBI.
Correct.
So how does a guy go about being recruited to the KGB?
Unlike the CIA, where you can actually apply, the KGB, you could not. They would recruit you. I wouldn't have known where the office was. They weren't in the phone book. And anyway, I would never have thought of applying because, you know, like everybody else or like most people, you know, spy stories are very interesting. We had our own spy stories. We had our own James Bond, communist James Bond. But that was all in the realm of fiction or in the realm of adventure. That wouldn't be me. I was going to be a college professor. That was my dream. But that changed one day when the KGB knocked on the door. I was in my third year studying chemistry, sitting in my dorm room on a Saturday doing a little bit of studying. And in those days, almost all the students that could would go home over the weekend. I couldn't. It was too far. So I was alone in my room. My roommate wasn't there. And that's interesting to note because the person who knocked on the door knew that, must have known it. The person also knew which room, behind which door to find me. There were no nameplates on the door. So after many years, it occurred to me I had a neighbor in the next room. There was a Russian exchange student with whom I had some interactions and talk back and forth. I guarantee you he was the one who fingered me.
Why do you think they chose you?
I was, as you probably know, in those days, the Stasi had files on everybody.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off, or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs, and My Lotto Rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breitinger, inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
And they apparently gave access to those files to the KGB, or maybe they gave the KGB some hints and look, you want to talk to this guy. If you systematically went through files for students, you know, the future intellectual elite of the Communist Party, the society, and so forth, I was a standout. You would shake this a little bit, and my file would come out for two reasons. I was an active party member. I was active in the Communist Youth Movement of the university. But the standout entry was that I had just received the Karl Marx scholarship.
Oh, wow.
Karl Marx scholarship was very rarely given. It was limited to 100 concurrent holders in the country. 100 concurrent. In other words, if you get a new one to go in, somebody else has to be out. And so they were looking, like the CIA, they're looking for the best of the best. And I was a good candidate on paper, right? So the fellow, I get this knock on the door, and we had a custom at college, at the dorm, that you know, when you went to visit another student in another room, you knocked and you walk in. The knocking was just telling them that somebody's coming. After the knock, the door didn't open, so I knew this would be a stranger. I say, come on in, and indeed, it was a stranger. The fellow was entirely unimpressive. He was short. He had his right arm in a cast. And he was just not likable. He was one of the few KGB guys that I didn't like. He was German. So right off the bat, I figured he was probably Stasi.
When you say Stasi, what does that mean?
East German Secret Police.
Okay.
Staatssicherheit, that's an abbreviation for security police.
Okay.
Okay. And then he came up. He asked me whether I am Albrecht Dietrich, that was my name. And I said, yes. What can I do for you? And then he came up with the dumbest statement I've ever heard a KGB agent give in my entire 10 years working with a couple of dozen KGB agents. He said, well, you know, I'm from Carl Zeiss Jena. That was a firm that was very well known in not only in Germany but in the world. It made high quality optical instruments. And then he said, you know, I just want to find out, do you have what are your plans after you graduate? Now, the reason it was dumb, because in those days, the entire time while East Germany was in existence, when you graduated from college, you didn't have the freedom to choose. You were assigned. So in other words, companies did not recruit. It never happened. That guy didn't even know how his own country worked. All right, so when he said that, I knew immediately that's he's making that up, and he's probably secret police. Now, I wasn't at all concerned that this would be bad. It had to be something, let's say, interesting. Mm. So we talked a while. You know, I played along with him, some, you know, small talk, and, you know, what it's like to study chemistry, which was... It was pretty hard because this is one of the subjects where you have lab. Mm. So you spent...
They want you to make poisons?
Every afternoon after you have your lessons and your seminars, every afternoon you spend 4 hours in the lab. Then you have to write lab reports. And then you have self-study. So my day started at 6 and it ended at 10. There was no play during the week. On Saturday, the morning, was lab. Saturday afternoon, that's when I went for recreation. I went to a soccer game, and then I went dancing, trying to pick up girls in a student club. I usually went home by myself. I was not as charming as I think I am now. It's too late. And I was very shy, actually, still. Anyway, so that's what we were talking about. Then he abruptly changed his tune. He did a 180, and he said, "You know, I gotta admit to you, you know, this was just a way to come in here. You know, I made that up. I'm really working for the government." I could have made him uncomfortable by asking what part of the government. I didn't want to do it. You know, I just wanted to hear what he has to say. And he came right out with it. He said, "Well, can you?" Could you imagine one day to work for the government? And I said, yeah, but not as a chemist. Mm. So,
do you think maybe they wanted you to work as a chemist in the beginning? Like maybe you make poisons and stuff like that?
You know, my best friend from college actually did work for the Stasi as a chemist. He wound up as the head of the forgery department. And he told me that the passports, West German passports he forged, they sold to the KGB. It is quite likely that he made a passport that I used to travel with.
Oh, wow.
So, yes, this is. I think he really recruited me because of what happened next. He recruited me for something, not science. Mm. Because he was a German who was a volunteer collaborator with the KGB.
Wow.
Wow. Right? I didn't know this. When he said government, I thought it was still secret police, East German secret police. So bottom line is he had asked the question he came to ask me for, even though not in so many words. And I answered him probably exactly, gave him the answer that he wanted to hear. Mm-hmm. So he invited me for to have a meal. When I say dinner, it's inaccurate. It's all Germany, the big meal is at lunchtime. Mm. So in the most expensive restaurant in town, I still remember what I had. It was my favorite meal. So, but as I walk in there, he was already sitting there in the back at a table, and there was another man at the table, which made me a little bit cautious because in those days it was not unusual for strangers to share tables because there were very often not enough seats. So I just approached the table slowly. But my man, who never, by the way, gave me his name, not even a cover name, he came up to me and walked me to the table and he said, I would like to introduce you to Herman. We are working with our Soviet comrades. Mm-hmm. So it was clear that it rhymes. That's why I'm going to say it. 1, 2, 3, I was with the KGB.
This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Masterworks. Did you guys know one of the most brazen art heists in history happened only 3 years ago in Russia? A man named Denis Chuprikov calmly walked into a crowded Moscow gallery, lifted a $1 million painting right off the wall, and walked right out the front door. Of course, this didn't end well for Denis, who was caught after trying to sell the painting online for only $37,000. Now, I know we've all thought about how valuable art can be. Few can imagine holding a piece of canvas that's worth millions of dollars. But what if there was a way for you to get a piece of all this crazy art money and it was backed by the SEC? I'm talking about Masterworks, the first platform where you can be an investor in legendary artwork from the likes of Picasso, Warhol, and Banksy. They buy these incredible paintings and put them on their platform. From there, members can buy shares, with each being an actual investment in the painting securitized by the SEC. Since 2017, they've sold 3 paintings, with each returning over 30% IRR to investors. Although I legally have to add, past performance does not guarantee future results. But still, 30%? That's crazy. And now, Concrete subscribers can skip the wait list to join over 350,000 people on Masterworks. Just click the link in the description box below. Back to the podcast. Wow.
So my German introducer said goodbye. Never heard from him again. And from that point on I was working with Herman.
Wow.
And it was a 15 months getting to know each other.
Uh-huh.
We talked about life. We talked about at this point it became clear that, they were thinking of preparing me for espionage in West Germany.
How old were you?
That time I was 21, or between 21 and 22.
Wow.
And that was interesting. We talked about, the espionage, about what's going on in the world. From early on, I showed how honest I am. I told him about some weaknesses that I thought I had, shyness with the girls, stuff like that. And then he started giving me some tasks. For instance, he would drive me to a building and point to it and say, see if you can find out what organization is in there. There was no nameplate, no nothing. So I had to, make friends with some people who walked out the door after work ended. I also one time was asked to knock on the door of a of a family and have a talk with somebody who opens the door to find out about their relative in the West. So that's sort of false flag interviews, so I pretended to be a sociology student and came with a survey. I asked him, could you answer some survey questions? Mm-hmm. Pretty innocent, but sounded good. And as we were talking, somehow I find a way to sort of talk about West Germany and make it into a little bit of a social conversation. And you wouldn't believe how easily people volunteer stuff that you want to get out of them. So I didn't like doing this because, you know, my shyness got sort of in the way, but I couldn't fail. You know, failure was not an option for me. So I believe this Herman guy eventually determined that I am a really good candidate. Mm. So he got in touch with Berlin, the headquarters of KGB in East Germany, and they invited me for a 3-week visit to Berlin. That was my first trip as a would-be agent, because I was given a code name, a code phrase, a time and a place where we would meet. And so I would go find that place in Berlin and meet my new friend, who introduced himself as Boris. I worked with Boris for about 3 weeks. He gave me tests to do, and he also gave me West German literature to read. Der Spiegel, Der Stern, the things that were forbidden. You were not allowed to have them, and almost nobody did. So that made me feel good, because, you know, I had one foot outside the law. But having always been a contrarian, wanting to be different from everybody else, that was very flattering.
How long did your spy training last with them? And then at what point, how long did it take for you to be deployed to the United States?
Okay, so the base training was 2 years. That was their standard training period. I was already working as a assistant professor in college when they finally made me the offer. Then on the last day in Berlin, I got the offer. And within a month, I quit the university and moved to Berlin. By the way, that will be interesting to know. In those days, in East Germany, good apartments and nice houses to live in were rare. So here I am, I'm now in the KGB. I go to Berlin. I would expect the key to a nice apartment. So I meet my new handler, the boss that I had for the 2 years in Berlin, and his name was Nikolai. Interestingly, he was Ukrainian. And we talk in his car, and then he says, I have a task for you. That's your first task. Find yourself a place to stay. Now, he knew, and I knew, everybody knew, that all apartments and houses were under the control of the government. There was a waiting list up to 10 years to get an apartment for a couple with a child. It was impossible to just go and rent an apartment. So I could have failed. This was a pass-fail task. Mm-hmm. If I can't find an apartment, if I can't find a place to stay, they don't want me. I needed to show my ability to improvise. Yeah, well, so I did. And I figured the further away from Berlin I get, the more of a chance I have. I took the city train to the last stop to a town called Erkner and knocked on doors and asked if somebody had a room. Eventually I found a place. It was an outbuilding. It was made out of brick, but it had two rooms. One had a bed and a chair, and the other one had a wood-burning stove and running cold water. And that's where I lived for 6 months.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. So the training, after 6 months, I think Nikolai determined, yeah, this guy is a keeper. So he gave me a key to an apartment. So the training in Berlin was 2 years, and I was going to be departing for West Germany after 2 years. One of the things I was required to do, everybody told me has to learn a foreign language. Mm-hmm. All right? And they gave me a choice. I said, well, I pick English. English was easy for me in school. You know, I was straight A's without studying. And like with everything else, I gave myself 100% into learning English. I became a maniac. And within 7-8 months, I had enough of a vocabulary to be able to read English novels without a dictionary. Every word that I, when I read stuff, every new word I wrote down and I learned. It came to about 100 words a day. I counted them. And so one day, some guy from Moscow comes to visit, and he asked me, so how's your English? And I said, well, I pulled a book out and said, I can read that, no problem. And he said, what? All right, we're going to get you a tape recorder, and you just tape a message. You can talk about anything you want. So a week later, I get the tape recorder. I give it back to Nikolai. He sends it to Moscow. A week later, I was on a plane to Moscow because they had heard enough to think that there's a possibility that I have enough talent to learn American English well enough to have nothing but a slight accent left that can easily be explained. So in Moscow, I met with a college professor who a Russian who taught English and a born American, and we talked for about 2 hours, and afterwards they discussed it between the two of them, and it was uneven. The Russian figured, nah, he can't do it, and the American typical American optimism, I can teach him. So bingo! Now they had a potential asset, somebody they could put into the ranks of the main adversary. That's what the KGB called the United States, as an illegal. So I was moved to Moscow to get another 2.5 years training, and then before they could launch me with the right documentation, it took another half year. So I spent 5 years in training.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was the perception once you were in the U.S. for so many years undercover? You had obviously a preconceived notion of what the U.S. was from, you know, being overseas. Was it accurate? And how did your perception change once you were in the U.S. for a certain amount of time?
Well, you probably know half the answer. Of course, it wasn't accurate. I came to the United States knowing, knowing that the United States was a dangerous enemy and had to be defeated, because the U.S. and NATO was in the way of the master plan that was, you know, creating the workers' paradise on Earth, you know, where there was no exploitation, there was no poverty, everybody got along. It's a pipe dream, obviously, but that's what I believed in at the time. Slowly, I got disabused of some of the strongest communist beliefs. When I had my first job, professional job, at MetLife as a computer programmer, we were told in the East, we were told there were like three types of companies that were the worst in the United States. It was the military-industrial complex type companies, the Wall Street investment companies, and insurance companies. And I started working at an insurance company. And they treated us very well as workers. We were paid well. We got free lunch. And we were even like pretty much promised the total job security. And I was constantly looking for the evil bosses. You know, there were some bosses you didn't like, but there was no systematic exploitation. There was no systematic, what you would call unfairness. You know, you, based on your performance, you could go up the ladder and make a lot more money. So this was all pretty good. So part of my ideology melted away rather quickly. What I was still at heart a communist. I just thought, just maybe there's a way to combine the good parts of capitalism with the dream of a communist egalitarian society and get everybody happy. That was actually a theory that was called convergence theory. It was developed by social democrat parties in Europe, and it was popular for a while. And I thought of thought that that might be a way out. Anyway, so we were misled. But here's an interesting statement. It is much easier to believe a lie if it has a kernel of truth. When you know something, when you can relate to something that is true, then everything else that you're being told that you don't know about, you think is true too. Example, we knew for a fact that in West Germany there were some ex-Nazis who made it all the way up to the top in the government. We called them neo-Nazis. At one point, the West German chancellor by the name of Kurt Georg Kiesinger was had been a member of the Nazi party. And the head of the Bundesnachrichtendienst, which is the equivalent of the CIA, was a fellow by the name of Reinhard Gehlen, who under Hitler was in charge of espionage on the Eastern Front. So we knew that there were Nazis in the West German government. We figured, you know, they would eventually come attack us and unite Germany and sort of recreate the Third Reich with the support of the United States. And that was the reason why, given why East Germany built the wall in 1961. And I believed in that too. You know, these Nazis that were going to come over and, you know, conquer us. So, and another lie, we didn't know that there was a kernel of truth, but we clearly didn't know that it was a lie, that the fact that the standard of living in the West was significantly higher than in the East was explained to us that, you know, the imperialists, the evil imperialists, were stealing all the wealth from the third world countries, like natural resources, fruits and vegetables and stuff like that. I had not really shed that belief because I had no information to the contrary. So now vice versa. So fundamentally, one more thing here. Fundamentally, nobody in the East, no high-level communist parties, members, philosophers, not the folks in the KGB really knew how the United States functioned. Didn't know. Were ignorant, because clearly they believed in their own lies. And here's the problem: if you want to deal with an enemy and you don't know how the system works, you're missing a joker in your deck. Vice versa. The CIA had no clue what was going on in the USSR. And I give you a very interesting example. I met the fellow who was in charge in the CIA for Eastern Europe, all of Eastern Europe. So he was a direct report to William Colby. And he wrote a book, and in his book is the most telling sentence, and sort of funny, goes as follows. I'm citing from memory. And so I sat in my office, he writes, I sat in my office and watched the only credible source of information about the Soviet Union, CNN. And this was in the context of, what happened when the Soviet Union fell apart. Nobody knew that. No, the same way when the wall came down, the CIA had no clue what was going to happen. Neither did the Stasi. Nobody. There was stuff that just happened. And when the Soviet Union fell apart, the CIA was caught by surprise.
Wow.
So there was a lack of understanding, cultural understanding, and an economic understanding. And it had a lot to do with being lazy and not really trying to get into it and believing in your own prejudice.
Mm. Going back to what we were talking about before, you said that during your time, there was maybe a max of 10.
Yes, there were 10.
10 undercover KGB agents in the USA.
I don't know if they made it. Mm-hmm. There were 10 that were trained,
right,
and sent out. It is quite likely that quite a few of them actually had to abort. When I look at the danger points that I passed There were at least a half a dozen where I could have been caught, where I could have blown my cover. The other guys were faced with the same problems. It's not easy to show up and say, "Hey, I've always been here."
Right.
Right. Then I told you how I was so careful with my integration in society so as to not betray the ignorance that I came here with.
Mm. Now, how did Moscow, how are they able to make sure that you weren't losing sight of the grand vision of all of this? Making sure, did they do anything to make sure that you didn't lose sight of the goal here? Because obviously it's such a long play. Like, you were doing this for so long.
Well, they didn't do much of anything other than that every 2 years I was back in Moscow. And I have to tell you, I also was married in Germany. I had a wife and a son.
Oh, wow.
So that was an anchor. You know, there was, I mean, you know, it's kind of hard to defect if you're endangering your family. And I wanted to go back and live with them. The other thing is the KGB trusted me. Their trust appeared to have been limitless. Now, this kind of a relationship is based on trust, right? If they don't trust me, they don't send me out. And if I don't trust them, I'm not leaving. I'm not going because, you know, they promised that they would take care of me. But I had established a reputation, and I didn't do this on purpose. That's the way I am. I have never been afraid to admit mistakes. So even during my training, there's some things that happened that were only known to me, but I told my boss I did this and this wrong. So I guarantee you in my file there was sort of an entry that says he is aggressively honest. And so they probably also didn't quite understand that over time, you know, changes will happen whether you want them or not. But there was no an attempt made to ideologically train me again, retrain me, or give me a boost. In those days, there was always this danger lurking about potential nuclear war. And it was mostly during Reagan's presidency that we were really concerned that Ronald Reagan was a madman and he would blow up the earth. He was a Christian, and apparently at least once he cited some passages from Revelation. And again, he is ignorance. The Russians thought, you know, that Reagan thought of himself as the man who would be used as a tool by God to bring about the end of the world. Revelation isn't meant that way for Christians, but, you know, again, we didn't have any understanding of the Christian religion. So we were literally very much afraid of Ronald Reagan.
Now, at that point, do you think there was a number of U.S. CIA undercover spies in Moscow?
No.
No.
Not Americans, you know.
No.
What American in his right mind would do what I did going to the United States? Because, you know, you don't want to live in squalor. You don't want to live in near poverty. That is a huge sacrifice. And on top of it, it's very difficult. It was a closed society. How do you get in there?
So is the process
America was
different?
Open.
Would they recruit people who are already on the inside there?
Yes, to the extent they had success, that's how they did it. And the most successful ones were volunteers, were like Russian high-level generals, even members of the KGB, who knocked on the door of the CIA and said, you know, I'm not happy with what's going on here. They were typically not for money. They did it because they wanted to, A, save the world from a nuclear war, and B, they were pissed off at what was going on in Soviet society.
Who do you think was the more elite spy agency, the KGB or the CIA?
That's a good question. They were both rather ineffective in the long run. The United States had their most... I already said that the United States had their most success by working with volunteers. The Soviet Union also. There's the two spies that did the most damage to the United States and had caused quite a few assets, CIA assets within the Soviet Union killed, were Aldrich Ames. He was a CIA employee. Aldrich Ames was actually in the department that spied on the Russians, so he gave away information, and named names. And Robert Hansen, who had a similar function, counterintelligence, in the FBI. Both of them did it for money. Both of them volunteered. Both of them are still alive, but they're rotting in jail.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And how was it that you eventually got caught? How did you eventually get into trouble?
That took a long time. So... So I come here in 1978. I make my way into a profession. I work at MetLife, and so I'm in the country for 8.5 years. When I made a mistake, I had a steady girlfriend who was a citizen of Guyana. She came here illegally. And at one day, she confessed to me that she was
closing up a little bit closer. Well, you can move it to its.
Well, she confessed to me that she was in the country illegally, and she asked me if I could help her become a citizen. And after some analysis, I figured I could do that, and it worked. So here's one illegal who made another illegal legal. But then the mistake was that I wasn't aware that this was, it's very typical for, West Indian ladies who want to move up. They catch themselves a man and then get pregnant. She got pregnant. She gave birth to a girl in, 1987. In the month of June, 1st of June. And that changed my life. I wasn't not prepared for that. So, but I'm seeing this little girl grow up. I watch her, take her first steps. And she had the biggest eyes and nice curls. A very, very pretty girl. And I've always had a great liking for pretty girls. Like, this was my daughter. And without really being aware of it, I fell in love with her. A big time. It was, I think at that point, that was the point when I became a human being, because I, up until that point, I was very much of an egomaniac, even though I wanted to help the world, but it was really all about me, I'm the special guy, I get to do things that almost nobody else can, and I'm eventually going to have decent money and have a good life. It was all about me. I left my German wife to spy in the Soviet Union. I could have, at that point, could have said, maybe I shouldn't. So I fall in love with this girl, and she was 18 months old when the KGB was spooked. Somehow they got some information through some channel that indicated that I was in danger of being caught. They decided to implement the emergency procedure. So there was a particular plan that we had in case I had to run. Either I find out myself that I'm in danger or they're telling me. The procedure was as follows. I had emergency documents a driver's license. It may have been a secondary document, Canadian, that I buried in a park in north of Manhattan someplace. I was supposed to retrieve the documents and make a beeline to Canada, going across the, I think it's called the Friendship Bridge at Niagara Falls. I had tested, they asked me to test how easy it was to cross. And in those days, you didn't even have to show documents. You just walked. So, and then make my way to Ottawa, where I would get in touch with a diplomat there, a KGB agent, and they would extricate me out of Canada. Straightforward, right?
Wow.
Now, that was, so, and I would have to set a signal telling them that I'm starting the emergency procedure. We had two signal spots. One was for me to put a signal. That was some place in Manhattan, and it was under a bridge, and this was next to a highway. When the Soviets lived in the north of Manhattan, and they would drive to work a certain road, and they would pass by that spot every day. So if I place a red dot, you know, a paint red dot on that spot, that means they would be alerted that I'm on the run. The other spot was for them to put signals there and for me to read, and that was on my way to work, on a support beam for the A train that ran above ground in that part of town. And one morning, it was in December, I went to when I was going to work, it was still dark. So I go down and, you know, as usual, I just take a peek and not expecting anything. And there was this red dot. May I use the S word?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because
it's the internet.
That is what popped into my head. Oh, shit. See, at that point, I was still trying to figure out, one day I need to go back. They will call me back. How do I take care of this girl?
So that was what that red dot meant.
The red dot meant emergency.
You're out.
Yeah, that actually, it meant, if you read this, you just don't go home, don't pack your bags, just make a beeline, collect the documents, and get out of there.
Wow.
Yes.
And you had documents buried in a park?
Yes. actually, that was then 9 years later when the FBI, when I started working with the FBI, we went and I found the documents that were still there.
Oh my God.
It wasn't really buried. There was a park bench that was broken and, you know, the concrete things on both ends that hold the board. There was one of those concrete elements that was still standing there without anything. So I pulled it back and put the document underneath. And, wow. And 9 years later, we're still there.
Wow.
That helped with my credibility with the FBI, you know.
So you saw this red dot.
Yeah. And I said, oh, shit. And because I wasn't ready to go. I had not found a way to take care of this girl who I loved dearly. Because
your daughter.
Yes. Her name is Chelsea. She's 34 now.
Yeah, same year. She was born a month before me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So, and her mother was poorly educated. She had, I think, four years of formal education. Chelsea would have grown up in poverty, no doubt in my mind. And I couldn't stand that thought. So I just decided to ignore the dot. Now, I told you, I was always a risk taker. There obviously was a risk. If the KGB was right and I hang around for some more days, the FBI will come knock on the door and I wind up in jail, right?
Right.
So I go to work. That day, I really didn't get anything done. I was just staring at my computer monitor and do nothing. And then I go home and I didn't sleep well. And I was just still thinking, what do I do? What do I do? What do I do? So I play for time. And so the dot was on a Monday. On Thursday was my regular there was a regular day when I listened to shortwave transmission every Thursday for 10 years at 9:15.
Okay. And what was the purpose of this?
Well, that was when that was how they communicated with me.
Oh, okay.
I never met another agent. I never met my handler in the United States. You know, you see that in the movies. Didn't happen with us.
Okay.
That was forbidden. It was too dangerous. Anyway, so I'm dialing the frequency. I'm listening. I decrypt the message, and it says, in so many words, "We have reason to believe that the FBI is investigating you. You know, start emergency procedures immediately." Blah blah blah, and that was the end. Okay, so reason to believe. They weren't really convincing. They didn't tell me exactly what the reason was. So I thought there was some hope, and I was still paying for time. I was still trying to figure out what to do. I also started to take some measures to find out whether I'm being under investigation. There's some things that you can do in your apartment where you, when something is moved, that people, when they look through stuff that is not in the same space anymore. Same.
So the stuff that you were trained.
No. I made that up. You know.
Okay.
There wasn't. But I was trained to do one thing, and I did that too, to find out how your mail is being opened. So you write a letter to yourself with a fictitious address. And, you know, write something in there. And when you close the envelope, you leave blank spaces in the glue. All right? So you close it, but there's a couple of spots, maybe an inch each, where it isn't glued. Because generally mail is opened by machines, and then it's closed automatically with machines. So when you get this letter and it's fully glued, you know you got a problem.
Wow.
Okay.
Wow.
And one other thing is I was extremely well trained to find out whether somebody's following me. So I took a day off and I was wandered around in New York City, and I saw absolutely no sign that anybody was following me. And because I got feedback in my training in Moscow from the head of this department, the guy was really, really good. He said, he gave me a compliment. He said I was one of the best he ever worked with. So that gave me more certainty that they may be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So at least gave me more time to play for time, because at this point, the KGB didn't know that I received the messages. I could have been in a hospital, right? Or my radio was broken.
Right.
Because one time I actually had an injury, and for like 3 weeks I could not do anything because my right arm was in a sling. But then they went to the extreme and did something that they normally wouldn't do. So on my way to work, it was a dark summer, winter morning. I'm waiting for the A train on the elevated platform, and from my right comes a short man in a black trench coat, and he comes really close. There weren't too many people around. It was early in the morning, and he whispers in my ear, "You gotta come home or else you're dead," and then he walked away. Now people think it was a threat, maybe 20%, but 80% chance was that, you know, he was a Russian. He spoke with an accent. He didn't quite understand what that phrase means. You're dead. You don't say it in this context, because then it could be taken literally. I can say to you, you know, if you do this, you're dead. It means you could lose your job, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a metaphor,
right,
or whatever you want to call it. So,
but it seems like you just didn't want to believe. You just didn't want to
believe. I didn't want to believe that this was a threat.
Right.
it could have been, but whatever. But here's the point. Now, they knew that I knew. So there was no more playing for time. In the next radio transmission, they called me to implement a dead drop operation. That's when when somebody drops something over there that, that has maybe money or a passport in it, some kind of a container, and you go pick it up. Mm. That's the real short description.
Right.
And they were actually, they changed the emergency procedure. They were going to me to give to me in an old rusty old oil can, travel money and a passport to get out. Still across to Canada. I still hadn't made a decision, but at least I was going to get the money, right? So and then I knew I would have to make a decision rather quickly. So here's what happened, which is the most odd thing in my entire career as an agent. The operation was in a park in Staten Island. The spot where the container was to be placed, I found, I described, I knew exactly how to go there. I knew, and I was told with regard to these types of operations, I was also very good. They actually used some of my descriptions to teach others how to describe a spot so it can be found. Mm. So this was in the dark for some reason. It's the only time we did this in the dark. And I go to Staten Island, and there was a spot where a signal was to be placed that told me, you can go and get the container. I did it. I put it there. The signal was there, so I walk into the park, and there was supposed to...
What type of signal was it?
It's a chalk mark.
Okay.
Real simple.
Okay.
And I get to that tree with a hollowed bottom. Was really, really easy to find, and there was no oil can. I said, what the heck's going on here? I did a double take. I wandered around a little bit. Maybe he just, like, dropped it, it was gone. I couldn't find the container. So as I walked away from that failed operation, it said in here, I'm staying.
Really?
You see this, how imbalanced this was, because obviously I was in danger in some way. And if I disobeyed the command from the center, I could have been in danger through the KGB, right? Mm-hmm. Because I knew they did not treat defectors very well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all the good things for me were back behind the Iron Curtain. The wall hadn't come down yet. That took another year. I just knew that I had a lot of dollar savings. And I had a wife and a child, and the Russians even promised me, once I'm done, they promised to give me a house, which was a rarity in the communist world. So everything good was over there, and everything not good was over here. The only thing that was the counterweight was a smile of an 18-month-old girl. And in here it said, I'm staying. And so now the people always ask, how did you do this? How did you manage? You know, brilliant. It's another thing that just popped into my head. Oh, yeah, I'm making up a story. So I sat down the next day. I wrote a letter in secret writing and told them, unfortunately, I can't come because I have HIV AIDS. And that was as good a lie as I could have come up with, because they believed it.
Really?
They had no reason to not believe it. They didn't know I had a child. They didn't know I was married in the United States. They didn't know any of this. They didn't know what was going on in my head. Mm. They all they knew this, yeah, man, I get to go back and you know, be celebrated as a hero because my 10 years were considered a success. The year before, I received the second highest decoration of the Soviet Union.
Wow.
Yeah. So they believed it. They believed it so well that they went to my German family and told them that I had passed away from this dreaded disease.
Wow.
I didn't know that they believed this until I was able to reconnect with Germany. That's when I was told what happened. So for the next 3 months, I was very careful not to be predictably in the same spot at the same time. Mm. So I would go to work at different times. I would go zigzag. You know, I just was unpredictable. And after I had already decided that the FBI wasn't coming after me, and after the 3 months, I said, "Well, I'm in the clear now. I'm going to live out my life as an American with this new family over here." And a year later, I bought a house, and then we had another child. So that was my future. Was I was going to have a nice career in information technology. And then retire, play golf, but never go back to Germany for sure, and never be able to travel outside of the United States, because the one thing I would have avoided is to apply for a passport again.
So you were okay with not seeing your original wife and your first child?
Yes. I had this really artificially split personality. When I was here, I was Jack Barsky, so I really... There were no thoughts about Germany left in me. And when I was back home, I was Albrecht Dittrich. It's really weird. Yeah. And that's when I told you that occasionally when a German word pops into my head, I can't find the English, because there is no real good connection between the English and the German in my head.
Wow.
So, yeah. And and then 9 years after I resigned, the FBI found me, and so that changed my life again.
How did that happen?
Well, there's this fellow, there was an archivist
Get this thing a little closer to you. You can scoot it.
There was an archivist in the KGB who was in charge of moving the archive from the Red Square, from Lubyanka, to a new facility outside of Moscow. And as he was doing this, he had access to all kinds of secret documents, and he was pissed off at the Soviet Union. He really wanted, he was trying to find a way to do maximum damage. So he hand-copied notes over many years, smuggled them out in his underwear or in his socks, buried them in his dacha, eventually transcribed them, and one day he showed up with 5 suitcases worth of documents at... the British Embassy in one of the Baltic republics. That was after the Soviet Union had collapsed. But you know, if the Russians had found him, they would have given him the death penalty. And amongst those documents, there was a brief note that there was an illegal by the name of Jack Barsky living in the northeast of the United States. And since Barsky is not a very common name, the FBI pretty soon figured who that was. It was me. And I think the confirmation that they received was, yeah, the fellow got his social security card when he was in his mid-30s. So yeah, that's him. It took him 3 years to actually introduce themselves. And I understand why. Because all they knew was that I wasn't illegal. And I was extremely well trained, because I had survived in the United States 19 years without being caught. So the concern was that I was still active, or I was at least still, you know, a sleeper who could be woken up any time. That was at the time when what I was telling you about Aldrich Ames and Robert Hansen, the two very dangerous and damaging agents that were in the CIA and in the FBI, they were concerned that I might be running yet another one of those agents in the U.S. government. So, and knowing that I was very well trained, they kept away. They watched me from a distance. They didn't really come close, except for... coming to my house at night and taking the garbage out and replacing it with other garbage, and then going through my garbage.
Wow.
And at one time when we left the house, the family, to go to Toronto to visit my wife's brother, they installed a listening device in my kitchen. And this was the moment when I got busted. So one day my wife and I had an argument in the kitchen, and she was really, you know, she treated me as if I was an enemy, as if I wanted to, you know, do harm to her. I don't want to get into the psychological background. It was just an argument back and forth, and I decided to use the nuclear option. I said to her, listen, I'm 100% on your side. I'm as supportive as anybody could be. I took a significant risk by staying here because I used to be a Soviet agent, and I was called home, and I decided to stay because I love you and Chelsea. So the FBI listened to that confession. They had it on tape.
Oh, my God.
Right? And as far as the nuclear option, it backfired because now my wife was thinking to herself, I can't trust this guy at all. He was a secret agent, right? So that didn't work very well.
She didn't even know.
No, she didn't. Oh, no, I kept it from her. As a matter of fact, when we moved in together, I found an apartment where there were three rooms and a kitchen were at one end of a corridor, and at the other end, there was one room. And I said to her, this is my office. When I'm in here, I cannot be disturbed because I'm doing like complicated stuff on the computer. And she observed that. This is where I did my spy work while she was in the other end of the same apartment.
Wow. So how long did it take the FBI to confront you?
From the moment they found me, that they knew that is the guy that we're after, about 3 years. And that came pretty soon after they got the confession on tape. And the fellow who is now a good friend of mine convinced headquarters that he had seen enough. He watched me from a distance, and he had seen me interact with my wife. He had seen me interact with my children. And he came to the conclusion that I loved my children. There were some problems between me and the wife, and he figured that because of the love for my children, I would absolutely cooperate. And mm-hmm. he convinced the headquarters, and so they said, okay, say hello. And he was 100% right. You know, after the first surprise, you know, after they say FBI, you know, we want to talk with you. Oh, my God. I caught myself rather quickly, though. I told him when we sat down in a motel, the first thing that I told them says, I am fully aware that the only way out of this for me and my family is if I 100% cooperate. I have no reason to lie, and I will cooperate. And you can give me a lie detector test, and you can double check some of the information that I give you. I will not lie to you. And I have a pretty convincing way of communicating what I think, and that was a good start. And then we did like 6 weeks worth of debriefing sessions. Eventually, there was a polygraph test, and I failed one question.
Really?
Yeah.
Which question?
I don't remember the question, but you know, when the guy who ran the test, he took the material, and you know, they have all these little graphs that they look at. He went to a room, and a half hour later, he said, you know, it looks pretty good, but you failed this one question. And I said, which one? And I forgot the phrasing. It wasn't so much the phrasing. At one point, a light went up here. I said, this has a double negative. He said, oh. So I had to go back another day, answer the same question without the double negative. And many years later, it occurred to me that was a test of the validity of the entire procedure.
Right.
Because I had to fail that one.
Right.
And the polygraph is so damn sensitive. And I ran this by some of my...
Kind of like a baseline.
Yes. Some of my FBI friends, and they said, yeah, he wanted to... He that was a check on his own judgment. And it was true, you know.
Now, what year was this that you finally got caught by the FBI and cooperated?
88 plus 9, 97.
Okay. 97.
Mm-hmm.
So during your years when you were still working with the KGB, did you ever have any communication or any kind of run-ins with Vladimir Putin?
No. Vladimir...
Was he working in Germany at that time?
Yeah, he was stationed in Germany in a city that is about 60 miles from where I grew up. I grew up in a small village, but that was one of the closest cities. He got there in 85. I was already here for 85.
Okay, so you never had any sort of communication.
But just to volunteer some information about what he did there, he would have been the kind of person that, let's say, if I study in Dresden, it's a good possibility that he would have been the one who I would be working with. Because the fellow that worked with me was a generalist, you know. In these outposts, they didn't do a lot of espionage work. It was East Germany. You don't spy on the East Germans, right? Mm-hmm. You maintain a relationship with the Stasi. You may meet somebody from West Germany who comes to visit, or you may actually, you know, operate as a courier for a little bit. Mm-hmm. But most of the work was maintenance, bureaucratic work, and working with trainees like me.
Right.
And so this is what Putin did, I guarantee you. He was mid-level. He wasn't even in charge.
Right.
And so the myth that is floating around about Putin, the 10-foot-tall KGB agent, is exactly that. It's a myth. Right. Unfortunately, a lot of Americans have bought into this. A lot of top-level politicians and journalists. When I first got interviewed about this Ukraine thing, the interview always started, so how did the KGB, the time in the KGB, enable Vladimir Putin to do what he's doing now? And I my answer is not at all.
Right.
The only thing that helped him, having been a member of the KGB, he networked with people who, when the Soviet Union went bust, and when the industry was privatized, and when there was politics that you could get into, guess who had the best chances? Because the KGB hired nothing but, you know, the top people, the elite. And KGB, actually, a lot of KGB knew how the West functions and how you can, you know, become a capitalist or an oligarch. So this network, there's still residues of that network that works with Vladimir. But all the other stuff that his ability to manipulate and play chess and intimidate and be brutal, that was not developed in the KGB.
Do you think it's possible that the person that Vladimir Putin is today that's a result of the United States constantly trying to destabilize Russia since, you know, for decades, and constantly, you know, antagonizing Russia and doing all the things that we've done? You know, you could talk about like the coup in the Ukraine and, you know, putting anti-ballistic missiles and or defense missiles that could easily be transitioned into offensive missiles all throughout NATO, and pushing them and backing him into a corner, so to speak. Do you think it's possible that who he's become today is an effect of all of that history?
It's an excellent question. First of all, just to lay the foundation, in the Russian national psyche, there is a lot of paranoia about being attacked, because Russia, since its founding, has always been attacked from the north, the Vikings, from the east, the Mongol hordes, and from the west, Adolf Hitler, the south. There was always war, and so there is a reasonably based fear amongst Russians, and most likely Vladimir Putin, of, you know, being under attack.
Right.
Vladimir Poznan, I don't know if that name rings a bell. He's a bilingual. He's actually trilingual. He speaks fluent and almost accent-free Spanish, French, German, and Russian, and French, Russian, and English. He, during the time of the Cold War, ran a program on U.S. television with a very, very famous talk show host whose name I can't remember. Vladimir Posner knew his stuff, and he knows his stuff. And he is not necessarily Russian, and he's not anti-American. He has a higher level view. And he gave a lecture at Harvard University maybe 3-4 years ago, and I watched it on YouTube, and he points out that, yes, there is at least part of what's going on right now can be attributed back to the actions and the words of the United States. Now, I also believe that Putin may not necessarily believe the entire story, but he's using it because his people believe it. Mm. You know, the NATO expanded right into the border of Russia, and we're not really admitting this right now in the open. I haven't heard any American politician to even address this in some way. I am thinking it is not, it was inevitable. I'm thinking it contributed, and I'm thinking again it had something to do with the lack of understanding how Russia operates. And Posner pretty much made the same case in his address to Harvard.
Mm. And another interesting, like I mentioned to you earlier, watching the 6 hour of sit down interviews between Vladimir Putin and Oliver Stone, is it seems like he does have the best interest for Russia, like whether he's putting on a tremendous act and being a tremendous, you know, being unbelievably deceptive and manipulative and putting on a show, you know. If that may be the case, then, you know, it is what it is. But it seemed like I was convinced that, you know, he does have the best in mind for Russia. And again, talking about his perspective of the United States, it seemed to be sound for what it's worth. It seemed like it was very logical. And, you know, he's a guy who has to deal with a new president every 4 years. And he watches this cycle happen every 4 years, and his perspective on during every U.S. election cycle, they have to demonize Russia. It's what they do. We're used to this from the United States. And it seems kind of silly in a sense, like from his perspective, looking back at the United States as kind of like they're just they're playing games. I'm trying to run this country as it should be. But again, you know, that's only one perspective.
There's a lot of thoughts that came to my mind as he was speaking. First of all, he's not stupid. And unless he ignores history, he should know that the United States, other than in Vietnam, has not been an aggressive country. We went into Kuwait and withdrew. We went into Iraq and withdrew. We didn't take any oil out. So when you're talking about playing games, yeah, he should know that these are games, right? And that American politicians have a big mouth and they always want to blame Russia and paint Russia as the main enemy, which is not the case anymore, by the way. Now everybody pretty much agrees that China is the biggest adversary. So there is some cynicism, I believe, in Vladimir's head. Also, one other thing I want to say: regardless of what the contribution of American foreign policy and military policy was, this does not excuse Mr. Putin going after a sovereign country and killing innocent civilians. And oh, by the way, if he really is so concerned about a Russian people, you know, he's killed quite a few Russians in the Ukraine, for sure. Mm. And I didn't watch the interview, but there is an article that he wrote he probably didn't write it, but he put his name under it, where he clearly lays out what his goal is in life, and it is rebuilding Greater Russia, uniting all the Russians that originally were part of, you know, the when Russia was formed, it was the organization was called Rus, R-U-S. And they had Ukrainians and Russians and other nationalities mixed in. And then throughout history and with all these wars, you know, they split up. And then the Soviet Union came back and united them all by force very often. And then the Soviet Union collapsed. And now what Vladimir Putin wants to do is recreate a cultural, unified Russia, a paradise for the Russian Orthodox sort of religion and culture, and make it all good for all Russians. Mm. But there's obviously there's a strong personal impetus at work here. He also wants to build for himself a monument that could be put next to Peter the Great.
He wants to recreate the Soviet Union, right?
I say Russia, Greater Russia, not greater the Soviet, okay. Because there are in the Soviet Union there were about a handful of Asian republics that have an Asian population. He's not so much interested in the Asians, and that possibly would create a conflict with China anyway. But you know, we're talking about. You know, the Baltic republics were at once part of Russia, and they have quite a few Russians still living there. You know, the Ukrainian language is very close to Russian language. I understand sometimes when they talk, the Ukrainians, I understand what they're saying. And the culture, they have the same Orthodox religion. Poles, you can count into that group. And he wants to create the Russian Empire. In that article, the focus is on Russia, Russia, Russia. Not so much getting bigger and like occupy the world and making Greater Russia the third big power on the planet, the way the Soviet Union was the second.
Mm. Let me ask you this. Why, if you're the United States, why not encourage Ukraine to make a deal with Russia and give Russia half of Ukraine, or at least why not let Russia take Ukraine? Wouldn't if Ukraine was part of Russia, wouldn't it make Ukraine more stable?
Well, the concern is that if you allow Putin to take over without taking any losses, that he would then have an appetite and the ability to go further. Mm. And then we got, you know, NATO countries in play.
Right. Isn't that sort of his buffer? Isn't Ukraine sort of his buffer between NATO?
In a nuclear age, that doesn't make a difference, I think. You know, I think it's vastly exaggerated. You know, whether you can fire intercontinental missiles from the United States and hit Moscow.
True.
You don't have to be in Kiev. I've had the same thought. You know, we need to... The most important thing, and I agree with the Biden administration policy in this respect, the most important thing is to avoid a nuclear disaster.
Right.
Because that would, there's no good solution, but this one would be the worst, right? And I'm concerned that there is a real danger that it might happen. Not necessarily because somebody purposely launched a nuclear weapon. When everything is in high alert stage,
when emotions are high,
and mistakes can be made, and I have no real information about it, but I'm concerned about the how well maintained the Russian arsenal is.
Really,
I've lived in Moscow for 2 years. The Russians, as far as industry, do not produce quality, no matter what they touch. Even
the biggest nuclear submarines in history of the world?
Yeah,
like,
but they are not necessarily all high quality. They're spaceships. They're not excellent. Mm. They function, right? So it's my guess that The American nukes are much, much better maintained and less prone to potential accidental misfiring.
What do you think? I mean, he's already killed a handful, I mean, thousands of people in the Ukraine. I mean, including his own armies. There's been thousands of Russians that have been killed. It wouldn't be much. I don't imagine it would be that far of a stretch for him to drop like a tactical nuke that would kill 100,000 people.
I have no idea what. My phone.
That's okay. What do you think would happen? What would be the next if that was to happen?
I have no idea how many lives a tactical nuke could destroy. But let's just assume whatever it is, and you kill 100,000 people. I'm afraid I pass. This is a wild guess. Because now if you're the decision, and who is the decision maker? Is it the American president or is it NATO commando? There are multiple decision makers. Would they decide to wipe out Russia? Would they let it go or would they just shoot one missile at one of the big cities in Moscow and then send an urgent message if we got to stop it now? I don't know if that starts. I don't know how to stop it.
Right,
and then that's a scary scenario, but possible. I hope and pray that somehow Zelensky will give enough for Putin to be able to go back home and declare victory. Because right now he doesn't look so good, you know. Because it's not going as well as he thought it would be going. And there's a good chance that five generals were already killed. There's a good chance that the military is not happy with him. So, you know, dictators are not immortal.
I mean, if you could imagine, like, put the shoe on the other foot, imagine that the Russians install some sort of leader in Mexico and they all of a sudden start funneling $1 billion of weapons and jets and stuff into
Mexico.
We
didn't install Zelensky, okay.
But the guy before Zelensky.
They're all homegrown. They were all homegrown dictator types, very similar to the ones. Their system was very similar to the one in Russia. And at the time when people were talking about it, honestly, more corrupt. It was a model of corruption. Mm-hmm. And with regard to the industry, the percentage of the gross national product that is controlled by oligarchs is very similar in Russia and in Ukraine, even though Russian economy is 10 times bigger. But they're both oligarchies even today. This was not the United States doing. And the whole idea of bringing Ukraine into NATO, let's say war's over and they want to be a member of the NATO. We can't have an oligarchy and dictatorship as member of NATO. That's a misfit. And how Zelensky eventually will turn out leading a country in peacetime, we don't know. We don't know.
Are you familiar with, after the 2014 revolution or coup or whatever you want to call it, there was a recorded phone call with Victoria Nuland and another high-up senator or something in the U.S. There was a recorded phone call between them, and Victoria Nuland is talking about two people and who would be the best fit to be the president of the Ukraine next. And she's basically saying, yes, we think this guy's the best fit. We just need to sign off from Biden.
Who is Victoria Nuland?
Victoria Nuland is the lady who was just interviewed in front of Congress the other day by, I think it was Marco Rubio, talking about chemical weapons being in the Ukraine. Right. She's been deeply involved with the Ukraine for a very long time. Neoconservative. Husband's a neoconservative. Her husband is Robert Kagan.
Okay.
And there was a recorded phone call with her talking about who would be the next best fit for president of the Ukraine after that coup.
Well, okay, but that's talk.
And
I don't think it is possible for the American government to install a president in a country like Ukraine.
Do you think during that revolution, when the opposition was going up against the police force of the Ukraine, the are you aware of, like the snipers and all the people that were getting killed?
There was the war was ongoing, and I told you about the journalist who told me who was the correspondent for The Guardian. He wrote a book, it's called The Long Hangover, and that has a lot of stuff is in there about the ongoing back and forth between Ukraine or within Ukraine and Russia and so forth, and it was deadly for a long time. There is no hint in his writing that the Americans had really anything to do with it. The guy is really good.
I'd be really interested to hear your thoughts. If we could find it, Austin, could you find the YouTube video of the recorded phone call with Victoria Nuland talking about the next leader of Ukraine? And she mentions Biden.
No, Biden was not in the picture.
He was the vice president. Obama was the president. He was the vice president at that time.
Okay, in 2014. And Biden was in charge of Ukraine.
Yes.
Yes, I remember that now.
And then he had his son. His son was a board member of one of the big energy companies that was formed
in
the Ukraine. Prices so fast forward. Violent. And
there was a phone call. That was
there, here it is, okay.
It was a call between full screen Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, Victoria Nuland, and the U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt.
Questions of credibility are being raised after a private chat between two top U.S. diplomats was leaked online.
I think Yats is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing experience. He's the guy, you know, what he needs is Klitsch and Tony Book on the outside. I just think Klitsch going in, he's going to be at that level working for Yatsenyuk. It's just not going to work.
I think that's right. Okay. Good. Well, do you want us to try to set up a call with him as the next step?
Sullivan's come back to me, VFR, saying you need Biden, and I said probably tomorrow for an attaboy and to get the deets to stick. So okay. Biden's willing.
So you had this remarkable phone call where you have these two senior officials of the U.S. government apparently talking about a coup or how they were planning to restructure the government of Ukraine.
Fuck the EU.
No, exactly. I'm not saying the whole
fuck the EU
feels that way. There is division on this, but the neoconservative element wants very much to change the strategic dynamic in Eastern Europe.
By the way, this documentary was just banned from YouTube last week. This was an Oliver Stone documentary.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So, you know, when I hear neocons being involved, the whole story has more credibility because the neocons and I think they're not all Republicans.
Hillary Clinton.
They're warmongers on both sides and they're hawks and they're irresponsible.
And you want to know something crazy about that lady Victoria Nuland? Her husband, if you could Google her husband, Robert Kagan, one of the biggest advocates of the Iraq War.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyways, the documentary is fascinating, and it goes into the whole thing, and they talk about agent provocateurs being a part of that revolution in Ukraine, killing cops and killing Ukrainian cops and killing parts of the resistance.
That sounds very similar to some of the worst activities that was conducted by the CIA, for instance, in Chile.
Right.
I mean, that was horrendous.
It's the CIA playbook, right?
Yes, and that was not supposed to be repeated. Now, if this grows, this could become one of the biggest scandal in the history of the United States. But yeah, we don't have enough to go by as to whether they actually followed through on the talk.
Mm-hmm.
There's the signals, and then Biden was in charge of Ukraine, but Biden was never a hawk, was he? I don't think so. Yeah, Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, and you don't know whether Barack Obama had an independent opinion, whether they saw eye to eye on these things.
Mm.
Hey, you're scaring me. But I'm at the edge of my sandbox that says competence.
Right. Well, in the interviews, you know, he discusses this with Putin, and Putin is very much aware of all of it. And he says, you know, this is what we're used to. This has been going on forever. During that revolution, he let forget the name of the current president that was there. He let him go to Russia. And the EU-backed president came and then took over Ukraine. Anyways, and then, you know, it's scary. It's dark.
but then you take the article that he wrote. It's about 6,000 words. It's a pretty lengthy, rather elaborate article about his plans. That doesn't say anything about, you know, responding to the evil United States. It says, right, this is my vision.
Right.
So that vision was there before.
True.
And even if we monkeyed in the Ukraine, that still does not excuse what Putin has done to innocent women and children.
Right.
There's no justification for that.
Now, we're doing... What is the U.S. doing specifically, like seizing the yachts of these oligarchs and going after the oligarchs? How does that cripple, or how does that hurt Putin?
The oligarchs, well, yeah, they become somewhat feckless once they all leave the country, if they are actually in opposition to the war. They may lose control of what they currently still control in Russia. I think what hurts more is limiting the ability of Russia to be involved in international commerce. Mm. I mean, they already have shortages all over the place.
Right. They have no Wi-Fi. I mean, they can't go to the grocery store. They can't watch Netflix.
And
can't go to McDonald's.
Yeah. Well, this is inconvenience, but. I don't know if the entire SWIFT system has been, Russia has been locked out of that. If so, they can't do any commerce. Because, you know, have you ever made money abroad?
No.
So I have. Euros, right? Mm-hmm. So you need to get a SWIFT account to get money transferred from there to here. Mm-hmm. So this is, SWIFT is the system that enables international commerce. And I think at least partially it has been blocked. To the extent Europe's still buying gas and oil, that may still be working. But the Russians are feeling it. Mm-hmm. And in his most recent speech, Putin has acknowledged it. And he said, well, yeah, we're going to have this, and this is all going to be pretty bad. But we need to get through this. It's for the greater good of the country. And... believe it or not, most of the Russians are behind him. So if people think, you know, oh yeah, there's mass demonstrations and he will be toppled by an angry populace, not going to happen. Not going to happen.
No.
Because there has been too much propaganda, whether that is right or has roots in reality or not. The majority of the Russian people believe in the propaganda that comes out of Putin's government. And that's it's an ideology. It's called Russian nationalism.
Mm.
And he's been pursuing that ever since he became the head of state.
Where does, in this, as far as this history between the United States and Russia and the Ukraine, where does George Soros fit into all of this?
I don't know.
Hasn't he's funded many NGOs that have been involved in the conflict in the Ukraine, as well as media companies.
And you know, Soros to me is an evil man who wants to change the world to his image sort of unified to some degree, but he won't be able to see it because he's so damn old.
Right.
I mean, he, you know his history, right? You know that he was
to an extent.
He was a young Jewish man who cooperated with the Nazis, and when he was asked about whether he has any regrets, he said, "No, I had to do this to survive."
Right.
It's a cold-blooded individual, and it's raw power. I thought what he's after is uniting all of the Western world in a sort of a collectivist-type system. What role Russia and even China is playing in his scheme, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you did a lot of homework.
Well, I mean, I used to always think, you'd always used to see, you know, I would hear people talk about, oh, George Soros is behind, you know, when you would see like the BLM marches and stuff like that, you'd hear people talk about, you know, George Soros is behind this, you know, trying to get people to cause violence. And then when I started watching these documentaries, seeing how he actually did create NGOs and fund media to create dissent in these other countries like the Ukraine, it starts to get deep.
Dissent as far as pro-Russian dissent?
Both ways.
You don't have to create it. It's there.
I mean, not
historically there.
Right.
There's a lot of Russians living there. And remember, I don't know if I told you in this interview, the hatred that Ukrainians have for Russians is based on Stalin's action when he starved 4 million Ukrainians to death in the 30s, okay? Because in those days, a lot of Ukrainians didn't want to be part of the Soviet Union, and right. Particularly the somewhat wealthy peasants didn't want to be collectivized. So this is what Stalin did. You know, he took the grain away from them, and so the national conscience of Ukraine, of the Ukrainians that consider themselves as, you know, part of a Ukrainian nation,
mm-hmm.
Has this incredible hatred for everything Russian. When that happened to me when I was still a Soviet agent, and I met some Ukrainians while studying in college, and I was blown away by when we talked about the Soviet Union, how much hate came out of them. So I had to stay away from Ukrainians.
Yeah.
Where was I going with this? And there are Russians living in the Ukraine. So that conflict was there before Putin invaded. And it's been going on since the Soviet Union fell apart. And there are some Nazis still living in Ukraine.
Quite a bit, actually, right?
I can give you one proof. I know I need only one piece of information. You know who? I forgot his first name. Pandera, Bandera, was a Ukrainian Nazi.
There's like statues of him, right?
He's
like,
Stepan Bandera.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Stepan Bandera was born in 19.
Big anti-communist,
yes,
anti-Semite.
Anti-Semite, and he led a bunch of folk. I mean, the Ukrainian Nazis were as murderous, even more so than the Germans, and they participated in pogroms and killed Jews and all that. Bandera was born in 1919. In 2019, the Ukrainian government issued a commemorative stamp to honor Stepan Bandera.
Hmm.
Enough said.
Isn't that when
Zelensky was not yet in power.
No, he wasn't. Okay.
Was not yet. But somebody high level enough thought it was a good idea to honor this Nazi killing machine.
I mean, it's crazy. It's the amount of power some of those I don't know what you would call them, Nazi militias in the Ukraine that are currently there. It's like the equivalent of, it'd be like the equivalent of the KKK having its own sort of military power in the U.S.
Yeah, and so what we're talking about right now is it cannot be found in United States media because it's too complicated.
It is complicated.
I think the entire Ukraine has been a hornet's nest for forever, and it would have probably been a good idea for the Western world not to meddle in this because it just isolated and let it play itself out, because no good will come of it.
But then you see, you know, what's the incentive for the Western world to meddle in this? And what you do see is you see, you know, the stocks of companies like Raytheon going through the roof. And then you see, you know, people that are in government investing in those stocks before this whole thing happens. And
yes. And, you know, that remember that President Eisenhower, a military man, warned of the power of the military-industrial complex. And that's apparently at work here. You know, we send a bunch of arms over there. They need to be replaced, right? The arms the money that we give away is taxpayer money, yours and mine. And, you know, the weapons manufacturers make more money.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And it's very often when people say follow the money, that's ultimately that dictates where people are going, you know.
Right. Well, I mean, it's hard to predict where it's going to go from here. Obviously, you know, it's definitely becomes a lot more sensitive when we're almost kind of in another Cold War. Are you familiar with, I'm sure you are, with the story of the Russian submarine commander?
Yes.
Who was, I believe he was off the coast of Cuba.
Right.
And it was, he was given the command to strike.
Yes.
Right? And he said that we're misinterpreting this.
Yes. Well,
what is that? How does that story go?
There were supposed to be three individuals who have to agree, or two out of the three. Generally three. But in this case, the commander had override power over the other two. The other two were going, they voted yes, and he says, I'm not doing it. And this was officially set up that way. I don't know exactly the background. Yes, that could have started World War III.
This one man could have prevented the nuclear apocalypse.
That is correct. And we might well be in a similar situation going forward here.
It's frightening.
Yes.
Terrifying.
Yes.
Well, Jack, I appreciate you coming and giving us your insight. Tell our people listening and or watching where they can see what you're doing as far as your own podcast, or where they can find the books that you've published.
Okay.
Or whatever anything else that you're doing now.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity. My website, there's quite a bit of material on the website, lots of videos and some writing. It's jackbarsky.com, real simple. If you can't remember it, just Google my name. It's all over the place. The book that was published 5 years ago, it's called Deep Undercover. I don't care about the subtitle. And last December, Imperative Productions released a podcast, a 12-episode podcast, which is about my life, but it's narrated, and it has a lot of voices other than mine. It's interviews who will talk about, you know, how they related to me and how they saw my situation. It is very well made. It has Alden Ehrenreich, an A-list actor, as a narrator, and professionally composed music. We got nothing but great reviews for it. Can be found on all major audio streaming platforms free of charge. That's it.
That's incredible. Well, thanks again. I very much appreciate it, and I'll include links to your stuff below in the show notes. Thanks again, Jack.
Okay.
Goodbye, world.